This lecture, entitled Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer and the Orthodox Rabbinic Seminary in Berlin, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas of Rabbi Avram ben Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Olav HaSholom, Rabbi Avram Gardin, a blessed memory. In previous lectures, we traced the revitalization of Torah in both Germany and Hungary to one individual, who through his genius, wisdom, and piety influenced succeeding generations. That man was a Rav HaGoyen, Reb Nosson Adler HaKoyen of Frankfurt, the Rebbe, the mentor of Rav HaGoyen, Reb Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, who revitalized Torah in Hungary and ensured its survival and blossoming for over 100 years in Hungary, and whose influence continues to be felt by descendants of Hungarian Jewry here in America and in Eretz Yisrael. Another one of Rav Nosson Adler's distinguished Talmidim disciples was HaRav HaGoyen Rav Rom Bing, the chief rabbi of Würzburg, Bavaria, in Germany, under whose tutelage Chacham Yitzchak Bernays, the chief rabbi of Hamburg, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, the chief rabbi in Abbezen of Altona, eventually developed to become, in their time, among the most influential rabbonim in all of Germany. In turn, Chacham Bernays and Rav Ettlinger had a tremendous influence on some of the most prestigious rabbinic leaders of the succeeding generation, including HaRav Sham Shafol Hirsch and HaRav Israel Hildesheimer. As we pointed out, Rav Hirsch, through his teachings, his example, and his fight on behalf of the creation of an independent Orthodox community, was responsible to a great extent for the perpetuation of Torah through Judaism in Germany. His teachings still inspire the Jewish world now over 125 years since his passing. Rav Hirsch was not the only one whose influence remained long after his passing. Germany was also blessed during this period with another multifaceted genius who left his indelible mark on Germany and on the world, HaRav HaGoyen Rav Israel Hildesheimer. Rav Hildesheimer, another disciple of both Rav Yaakov Ettlinger and Chacham Yitzchak Bernays, served as a Rav first in Eisenstadt, Hungary, and then in Berlin, Germany, over an independent Orthodox congregation, similar to that of Rav Hirsch's in Frankfurt. Also similar to Rav Hirsch, as soon as he arrived in Berlin, Rav Hildesheimer established an elementary school for both boys and girls, where Torah and secular subjects were taught. Furthermore, just like Rav Hirsch, Rav Hildesheimer was a gifted writer who fought tirelessly against reform and promoted through his direct influence in writings that form of orthodoxy which is commonly referred to as Torah and Derech Eretz. An orthodoxy that combined Yerushalayim, fear of heaven, Limudat Torah, devotion to the study of Torah, Dikduk B'mitzvahs, careful performance of the mitzvahs, Hashem's directives, together with an intimate knowledge of the secular world. In addition to all of the above, Rav Hildesheimer was also the founder and rector, Rosh Yeshiva, of the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, an institution that produced the majority of the many Orthodox Rabbonim that served German Jewry up until World War II. Moreover, Rav Hildesheimer was also one of the leading poskim, world-renowned halachic authorities of that period. All in all, during his lifetime, Rav Hildesheimer produced over 150 books and articles. After his death, two volumes of his tshuvas, halachic responsa, as well as two volumes of his chedushim, novel interpretations of the Talmud, were also published. There still remains, it seems, much more material in manuscript. Rav Hildesheimer was born in Halberstadt, a small town in Saxony, to a respected rabbinical family. His father, who gave shiurim, Talmudic lectures in Halberstadt, had been a Talmud, a student, in his youth of a Rav HaGoyen Rav Pinchas Horvitz, the brilliant chief rabbi of Frankfurt. Rav Israel Hildesheimer himself began his education in the local school in Halberstadt, Hashoras Tzvi. Founded in 1795, it was the first institution of its kind to train students in both Torah and Derech Eretz, secular subjects. It was an intensive school with 6 hours a day devoted to Jewish studies such as Talmud and its commentaries, as well as Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. This was besides the French, Latin, or other secular subjects that were taught there. This school and its philosophy seems to have laid the groundwork for Rav Hildesheimer's own worldview. At the age of 17, Rav Hildesheimer left home and his widowed mother to study under her Rav Yaakov Ettlinger in Altona. At that time, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger had just arrived and opened up his yeshiva there. There, Rav Hildesheimer was renowned not only for his brilliance, but also for his intense hasmada, diligence. Regarding those years, Rav Hildesheimer wrote, quote, "When I studied with my master in Altona, although I was not far from my mother's home, still I did not visit my mother until the end of 4.5 years. And my mother, my teacher, did not request this from me earlier." Evidently, since Rav Ettlinger saw in Rav Hildesheimer the making of a future Gadol Torah giant and manhig, rabbinic leader, he gave his prized disciple special permission to travel regularly to the neighboring city of Hamburg to attend the philosophical lectures that were delivered by Chacham Bernays. From all accounts, these lectures seem to have made a deep impression upon Rav Hildesheimer and influenced his thinking. In addition to the Talmud and its analysis, Rav Ettlinger also taught Rav Hildesheimer history, philosophy, and philology, and moreover exposed him to the workings of the Beis Din of Altona, at the time the only government-recognized Jewish court of law in all of Germany for adjudicating civil cases. Recognizing his own unusual talents, and coming to the conclusion that in order to combat the growing reform movement within Germany, it was essential for an effective Orthodox rabbinic leader to have, in addition to a broad Talmudic and halachic knowledge, a university education, at the urgings and blessings of his rebbeim, his mentors, Chacham Bernays and Rav Ettlinger, who also studied in university. In the year 1843, Rav Hildesheimer entered the University of Berlin, where he studied philosophy, Semitic languages, history, mathematics, physics, and astronomy. The greatest part of his day, however, was spent in learning Torah in the Klaus, the Beis Medrash in Berlin, the equivalent of a kolo, under the teaching tutelage of Rabbi Michael Landsberg, a remarkable individual in his own right, who also seems to have had a profound influence upon Rav Hildesheimer. In 1846, Rav Hildesheimer left the University of Berlin, continued on to the University of Halle, where he studied Semitic languages under Professor Emil Roediger, a disciple of the renowned philologist Wilhelm Gesenius. It was there in that same year that Rav Hildesheimer received his doctorate. His dissertation was entitled, quote, "The Correct Way of Interpreting Scripture," end quote. During that same period, Rav Hildesheimer studied for and received the smicha rabbinic ordination. Now equipped with the necessary tools, Rav Hildesheimer returned to his native Halberstadt, and as the secretary of the Halberstadt Jewish community, completely dedicated himself to learning and teaching Torah and to strengthening Yiddishkeit within Halberstadt. In that capacity, he also successfully articulated the cause of Orthodox Judaism against the forces for reform in the courts as well as in the press. Amongst his students during this period was Rav Marcus, or Meir Lehman, who eventually became the Rav of Mainz and the editor and publisher of the weekly journal, The Israelite, a powerful organ on behalf of Orthodoxy. Rav Marcus Lehman is also known as a popular author of children's books that capture the flavor of traditional Judaism and transmit it to many thousands of readers in Germany and eventually here in the United States. It was also in 1846 that Rav Hildesheimer married his lifelong companion, Henrietta Hirsch, daughter of a wealthy Halberstadt businessman and a distinguished woman in her own right. During this time, Rav Hildesheimer's reputation as an articulate Talmudic scholar grew, and in 1851, he was asked to serve as the chief rabbi as the Austro-Hungarian town of Eisenstadt. The community contained various factions, including traditionalists who were hostile to Western culture, were opposed to appointing a rabbi who preached in a polished German, not Yiddish, and who had received a doctorate in a German university, the first such rabbi in all of Hungary. There were also a small number of Reformed Jews, or Neologues, as they were referred to in Hungary, as well as Orthodox Jews, who were receptive to Western culture. These, it seems, formed the majority of the community. As soon as Rav Hildesheimer became Rav, he proceeded to implement steps which he felt were vital to the preservation of Orthodoxy in a changing world that was quickly becoming Westernized. In his opinion, in order for Torah scholars to gain the respect of the general community and to effectively influence them, it was essential that they have, in addition, a broad secular education. Consequently, Rav Hildesheimer created a unique yeshiva, a Torah institution that was unprecedented in both Austria-Hungary and Germany. All of the teachings were in pure German, not Yiddish. In order to gain admission to the program, each student had to be familiar with the German language, geography, general history, and mathematics. For those who didn't yet qualify, a preparatory program was initiated. Although the lion's share of the day was devoted to the standard yeshiva curriculum, many other subjects were also studied. Students attended classes for 51 to 53 hours a week. 30 were devoted to the Talmud, its commentaries, and Halacha, Jewish law. 2 to 3 hours were devoted to Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. 2 to 3 hours a week to Diktuk, Hebrew grammar. 3 hours to develop their German linguistic skills. 2 to 3 hours of Latin, i.e. the writings of Virgil and Cicero. 2 hours of Hungarian. 1 hour of Greek through the writings of Homer. 5 hours of mathematics. 1 hour geography, 1 hour history, and 1 hour natural science. Rav Hildesheimer himself taught between 35 to 40 hours a week. He taught Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, the Talmud and Halakha codes to the most advanced of his students. He also taught secular subjects to all of his students. He wanted them to see that it's possible to be a Talmud Chacham, a Yoreh Shamayim, and yet be well-versed in secular studies. He also encouraged the use of Hebrew, Lashon Kodesh, as a spoken language within the yeshiva. This school was the second largest in all of Hungary, the largest being the traditional yeshiva in Pressburg, Pressburg, under the direction of the Chassam Sofer's son, Harav HaGoyim Rav Rom Shmuel Ben Yamin Sofer, the famed Kesav Sofer. In 1869, the last year of Hildesheimer's tenure in Eisenstadt, the enrollment in the yeshiva was 134. 120 were regular students and 14 were in the preparatory program. During this period in Eisenstadt, Rav Hildesheimer produced students who went on to become great Talmidei Chachamim and Manhigim, leaders who, like their master, exemplified Torah and Derech Eretz, such as the Rabbi Gomer of David Zvi Hoffman and Rabbi Gomer Mordechai Halevi Horvitz. Although Rav Hildesheimer enjoyed being in Eisenstadt, he realized his innovative program of combining Torah and Derech Eretz with secular learning, which he felt to be the only effective tool to combat assimilation and to guarantee the preservation of Torah, was met with fierce criticism amongst nearly all of the other leaders of Hungarian Jewry. They felt that exposure to Western learning would only worsen the situation, and consequently, they believed that the most effective tool was in promoting isolation from Western society and modernity, and total dedication to the traditional mode of Torah study. In essence, they were only continuing on with the same isolationist approach taken by the Chassam Sofer. From a historical vantage point, even though secularism and neologism eventually did take hold in Hungary, through the firm efforts of such impassioned traditionalists, such as Rav Hillel Lichtenstein, Rav Chaim Sofer, Rav Hildesheimer's fiercest critics, there remained in Hungary up until World War II a very large group who were thoroughly immersed in Torah study and were dedicated to the complete fulfillment of mitzvahs without compromise. From a sociological standpoint, although this isolationist approach is not appropriate today for the majority of American Jewry, the success in America of the Satmar community and other such groups, who by and large have kept their children within the fold, is living proof of its effectiveness. As an aside, it is important to note that the disagreement between Rav Hildesheimer and his opponents was only in terms of strategy and tactics. Both sides believed in the primacy of Torah study and the observance of mitzvahs. The question was, under the circumstances of increasing westernization, what were the best and most effective measures to be taken to preserve Torah true Judaism? Now, as a result of the isolation that Rav Hildesheimer experienced within the Hungarian rabbinate, living in Hungary became for him increasingly more uncomfortable. And when the opportunity presented itself and he was offered the position of chief rabbi of the Hadas Yisroel, the independent Orthodox congregation in Berlin, he returned back to his native Germany, where he felt that his approach of Torah and Derech Eretz would be much more appreciated and effective. To give you a sense of what life was during his years in Eisenstadt, I quote on page 1 from the memoirs of Rav Hildesheimer's daughter, Esther. Also, we have a glimpse into the life of Rav Hildesheimer's Eishes Chayil, Rebbetzin Henrietta Hildesheimer. You can read this yourself. Maybe it's just worthwhile for me just to quote here. You can look in the first paragraph. The first paragraph, the daughter describes her father. In the second, she describes her mother. She says, let me just read you from the second paragraph, B. On the whole, my childhood memories center primarily around my mother, an important personality in her own right who gave us her guidance. And she continues, we loved our walks with mother. She was familiar with botany and could tell us the name of each flower we passed. The old days when chemistry had not yet progressed to its present state, many ailments were treated with home remedies, and it was mother who taught us how to distinguish between harmless and poisonous herbs. And she continues on, mother knew something about everything. When she walked with us through the fields, she taught us to distinguish between rye, wheat, oats, and barley, to identify fruit trees according to their species and stages of development. She could become annoyed with us if we could not distinguish between the various types of field produce. She was able to help us also in our academic schoolwork, whether it was French, English, or mythology. But what amazed us most was the breadth of her knowledge of arithmetic, and even more of geography, which had always been her favorite subject. We'd come to her for help also if we had difficult pieces of needlework to do. But you can see she was a real partner with Israel Hildesheimer. Since his coming to Eisenstadt, the conservative movement of Dr. Zacharias Frankel through his Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau had gained ground, producing rabbis who eventually took pulpits throughout Germany, but were dedicated to the gradual reform of Judaism. In addition, soon after of Hildesheimer's arrival in Berlin, in 1872, under the auspices of the official chief rabbi of Berlin, Dr. Abraham Geiger, Rav Hildesheimer was only the rabbi of a much smaller but independent Orthodox community, the Reform movement created their own rabbinical seminary called the Hochschule für die Wissenschaft des Judentums. Since both the conservative and Reform institutions, which were viewed with much respect throughout Germany, were dedicated to the advancement of Wissenschaft des Judentums, critical Judaic studies, Rav Hildesheimer felt that the only way the Orthodox could gain equal respect and footing within Germany and combat the growth of non-Orthodox Judaism was to create their own similarly designed rabbinical seminary. This seminary would be dedicated not only to the traditional values of Torah study in Yerushalayim, fear of heaven, but also to the advancement of Wissenschaft, Jewish studies, where in addition to their rabbinic degree, the graduate would be required to receive a doctorate from a recognized German university. The Torah curriculum of such an institution would also have to be broadened to include, besides the study of Gemara Talmud and its commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch and other halakhic decisors, would also have to include Tanakh, Mishnah, Diktuk, Hebrew grammar, Jewish history, Musar literature, pedagogical techniques, homiletics, the art of delivering a drasha, a sermon, and medieval Jewish philosophy. After a year and a half of serious fundraising, in October of 1873, Rav Hildesheimer's dream became a reality, and the first modern Orthodox rabbinical seminary opened its doors. At the time, it had 20 students. 7 were considered full-time degree candidates. The other 13 students had to first complete a gymnasium, or German high school course of education before being officially accepted into the rabbinic degree program. Most of these other students came from areas outside of Germany. Der Israelit, the journal published by Rav Hildesheimer's disciple, Rav Marcus Lehman, described the dedication ceremonies of this new institution. I quote it on page 2, paragraph A. You can read it yourself here. And this is how Rav Hildesheimer himself described the new institution and the benefit which the entire Jewish people derived from it at the opening ceremonies of the Orthodox Rabbinic Seminary. And here I quote an excerpt on page 2, paragraph B. The raising of funds for the establishment of the seminary in less than a year and a half testifies, like 100 witnesses, May Aiden, to the pressing need for an institution founded on the basis of Orthodox Judaism, whose goal will be to qualify its graduates as rabbis based upon a fundamental and all-embracing knowledge of the Bible, Talmud, and all the works spawned by them. Secondarily, our goal is to present them with knowledge in all branches of Wissenschaft, des Studentums, in as much as such a knowledge is a demand of our times. In paragraph C, on page 3, I quote from a fundraising letter that Hildesheimer sent throughout Germany and beyond. You could read it by yourself. Truth be told, the inclusion of Wissenschaft des Studentums, a field that was founded by Leopold Zuntz, an early leader of reform, and expanded upon by scholars who on the whole either did not practice Judaism at all, such as Dr. Abraham Geiger, or embrace heretical beliefs, such as Dr. Zacharias Frankel, was a cause of alarm amongst many Orthodox rabbis, such as Rav Sham Shmuel Hirsch, who was against the inclusion of such teachings and methodology in a rabbinic seminary. Rav Hildesheimer, however, felt that it would be impossible to combat the forces of conservative and reform without its inclusion. Since the scholars of the seminary, such as a Rabbi Goyen, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, Rabbi Jacob Barth, Rav Rum Berliner, and his son, Rav Hirsch Hildesheimer, were all both pious and knowledgeable in Torah and in general studies, Rav Hildesheimer was confident the atmosphere of the school would be imbued with Torah and Yerushalayim. Another concern voiced by critics was that since the time spent in the seminary was divided between traditional Torah studies, Wissenschaft, and work on a doctoral dissertation at a university, the final products of such an institution would be far inferior to the traditional Talmudic scholars which were being produced from the yeshivas of Hungary or Lithuania. I mean, they're only 24 hours in a day. In Rav Hildesheimer's view, this was a cost that had to be borne in order to produce rabbinic leaders who would be dedicated to Orthodox Judaism and yet possess the tools to ably defend it from the faculty and graduates of the conservative and reform seminaries. And in that sense, he was very successful. As the graduates of Hildesheimer Seminary ably served German Jewry up until the Second World War. In his lifetime, Rav Hildesheimer passed away in the year 1899. He saw the student body of the institution grow from 20 to 60. But the truth was that on the whole, the graduates of the Berlin Seminary were more liberal than the rabbinic followers of Hirsch. And in many instances, the division between them was evidenced by their approach to Auschwitz, successions of the Orthodox community from the general community, which leads us to the next part of this lecture. Now, I'd like to begin the next part of this lecture with a brief description of one of the most influential rabbonim of this period, a Rav HaGoyim Rav Yitzchak Doiver Zeligman Baer Bamberger, the Rav of Würzburg, a leading Talmud disciple and successor to Rav Avraham Bing. Now, in his generation, Rav Bamberger was one of the leading Talmudists and poskim, legal decisors in all of Germany. He was born in Weissenbrunn near Kissingen, in Bavaria. The name Kissinger comes from Kissinger. This is southern Germany in 1807. Evidently a childhood prodigy, he attended the prestigious yeshiva of Rav Wolf Hamburger, one of the preeminent rabbinic scholars of the time in Fürth, Germany, before his 15th birthday, and eventually studied under Avram Bing. Since he had no desire at the time to enter the official rabbinate, Rav Hamburger totally immersed himself in the study of Torah and did not feel the need to pursue secular studies, a must at the time for anyone contemplating a rabbinic career. Fate would have it otherwise, however, and in 1839, due to ill health, Rav Bing retired from the rabbinate. Those of the community who were well aware of the spread of reform were nonetheless dedicated to preserving the legacy of Rav Bing, looked to Rav Bamberger to become his successor. The reform element within Würzburg, however, sought a candidate more in keeping with their own philosophy and were therefore strongly opposed to Rav Bamberger's candidacy. In addition, at the time, Rav Bamberger had not as yet acquired any secular training. Due to the lobbying by the reform movement, the Bavarian government demanded that every newly appointed rabbi should have a university education or its equivalent. In a very short time, however, Rav Bamberger acquired a thorough knowledge of Greek, Latin, and modern German to the satisfaction of the governmental authorities, and because of demands of the community, delivered his drushes, his sermons, in a polished and educated German. To give you a sense of the power of the reform element in Würzburg during that time, I'd like to quote the following. Here's on page 3, let me just translate. This is section 3, paragraph A. The question was about the moving of the Bima, which was traditionally the Bima where the Torah is read, which is traditionally in the middle of the shul, the Beis HaKnesses, to move it to the front, as in Reform congregation, and simply because of the aesthetics, because in a church, which nobody knows what the hell the church looks like, but in a church, there's nothing, there's just the rows, and everything else is in the front. And they really wanted to make it look closer to a church. So there's a tshuva written by this is Rav Bamberger, and it says Yeshle Samets. One should put great effort Lasas Habima Bebote Knesses to put the bima the reading table in the synagogue Shenivdin Mechodesh, which are going to be built new. As building a new shul, make sure it's designed that the bima is in the middle. The Kol Shekein. Certainly don't remove it from the existing synagogue. The Kfar Harichu Binyan Bishalas and Shuvas Chum Sofer. It continues on. There is at length the Chum Sofer speaks of it, and in the lecture we gave regarding the Chum Sofer, we mentioned it. The Imtaimar says, Shagam Beis HaKnesses the Khan. So you're going to ask me, here in Würzburg, in the synagogue, Eina Bima, the bima here is not in the middle. Alzeh Oshev, to this I respond, Shabbos HaKnesses the poi hucho libonis. I guess the present synagogue, began its building, Terem Voyi Lekan, before I came here. The Oz HaRav HaGoyim, Reino HaRav Avram Bing, Zecha Tzadik, Levrach Chayil Mabo, Shehoya Oz Mora De Asra, who then was the spiritual guide, Kvar Hoyachoyla, he was ill. So they did this on their own. They didn't ask him, he was incapacitated. Vanoichi Hatsoyer, and I, the Achwe Boilakan, after I came here, Hoyacholti Lakav, I couldn't hold them back. I couldn't do anything. This is Beitayim, says that Loyakav, Beitayim Loyola Beyodi Lasaka, Sashanasa Kvar. And in the meantime, says from, I wasn't able to change that which already was done. So you see that there was a very strong reform element there. He was able to do what he did, but he knew which battles to pick. And we had discussed that the custom, basically, the Chassam Sofer has a novel idea, but basically, as the Rambam has it, the custom of having the bima in the middle was based on it's utilitarian. If it's in the middle, everyone could listen. The problem was that the reason they wanted to make the change was just based on was based on this whole reform ideology, but he couldn't change anything.
Does this mean that the reform in the Orthodox happened in the same show?
Yeah, there was no, you're asking about the reform in Orthodox. There was, in a place like where there was only one shul. And basically the Orthodox were in control. This was the only thing that they were managed, the reform were able to make any change. Now, Reb Bamberger was a prolific writer. Besides the many tshuvas, halacha responses to other rabbinic scholars, which record in his Yad Levi, as well as his son's work, Zecher Simcha and the Tia Simcha, he wrote practical halachic works which were designed to be used by the community at large, such as Amira LeBeis Yankov, about family purity and duties of a Jewish wife, Melecha Shemayim, regarding the correct methods of writing a Torah scroll, Mora LeShochtim, a manual for shochtim ritual slaughters, and Nachlas Davash regarding chalitza. In addition, he wrote scholarly treatises such as Yitzhak Yiranen, a commentary on the works of the early Spanish authority of Yitzhak Ibn Gayas, and Korah Be'emes, an explanation of the instances in Talmudic and Midrashic literature that our sages employed an alternate pronunciation, Al-Tikret, to derive various teachings. After his passing, Reb Bamberger left 28 volumes of response to Chiddushei Torah, New Insights into the Talmud and Poskim, and Drusha sermons, only a small portion of which was published after his death. He was also fiercely involved in the fight to preserve Judaism against the efforts of the Reform movement. I quote here, because of time, I can't. I quote two of his tshuvas regarding issues regarding reform. Just in the first one here, there is a question of a woman who wants to marry a non-Jewish man because of the age, whatever, she can't get married without the permission of the mother. She claims, if you don't give me official permission, says, I'm just going to escape, become a Christian convert, and marry this man anyway. At least, if you give me permission, I promise that I'll have these children who were brought up as Jews, and I'll give them a bris milah. Should the woman ask, should she give official permission for them to get married? It gives you just a sense of the times. And he says, by no means should she give permission. What happens to them happens to them. You should not be involved in it. These are the type of things. Although there was a major university in Würzburg near the yeshiva where many of Rav Bing's Talmidim, disciples, such as Rav Etlinger and Chacham Bernays had attended, Reb Bamberger did not encourage his Talmidim, his students, to study in the university. And in fact, Reb Bamberger's own children, who most became practicing rabbis in various communities of Germany, did not attend university. He did ensure, however, that they privately took lessons in secular subjects so they would be able to relate to the acculturated German Jewish populace and also be able to receive official government approval as he himself had received. Although he realized that it was important for rabbis in Germany to be acquainted with its culture and language, his approach to the place of Torah study and its relationship with the world at large was similar to that of his Rebbeim, his great teachers, and their Rebbeim before them. He did not completely embrace the Torah and Derech Eretz philosophy of Rav Hirsch, who felt more strongly that it was a mitzvah in that era for Jews to be thoroughly versed in the culture around them, often at the expense of their acquiring expertise in Torah. It seems that for that reason, Rav Bamberger only founded an elementary school that combined both Torah and secular subjects. The yeshiva beyond the elementary level was solely devoted to Torah study. Reb Bamberger also was very much opposed to the approach of Israel Hildesheimer, who felt that the Orthodox rabbis in Germany of that era should not only be university educated, but also strongly grounded in Wissenschaft, the scientific and critical approach to Jewish study similar to the graduates of the conservative reform seminaries. Reb Bamberger felt, and probably rightfully so, that such an approach would not produce rabbonim that were true Talmidei Chachamim, great Torah scholars. Such scholars, he felt, were sorely needed to inspire and instruct German Jewry. On the other hand, he did realize there was an urgent need to train teachers who were both learned in Torah and also possessed the ability to make an impact upon the acculturated Jewish students of that time. Consequently, in 1864, Rav Bamberger founded a teacher's seminary in Würzburg. Over the years, the graduates of the seminary were able to fill important teaching positions throughout all of Germany. You know, here in Detroit, Rabbi Dr. Eric Greenbaum was a graduate of that Würzburger's teacher's seminary. By the time the seminary was closed by the Nazis in 1938, the seminary had graduated over 700 students, many of whom had been trained not only in teaching, but also in shechita, ritual slaughter, milah, circumcision, and chazonas, cantorial singing. Besides for the needs of his community, Rav Bamberger was also very involved in the yishuv, the nascent community in Eretz Yisrael. Much time and effort was spent on his part to raise sufficient funds to provide adequate housing and medical care for the growing number of impoverished residents in Yerushalayim. Now, it was only natural that such a towering individual like the Würzburger Rav, Rav Bamberger, would be consulted regarding the issue of Auschwitz, leaving the general Reform-controlled community to form an independent Orthodox one, the subject of the last lecture. In fact, over the years he had ruled, Rav Bamberger had ruled, that it was forbidden for a Mechalel Shabbos, a Sabbath violator, to serve on a community board. And regarding the secession of the Orthodox communities from the general communities, in several instances, he had supported their withdrawal. For instance, in 1872, he had signed a letter in support of the secession of Rav Zalman Spitzer, the son-in-law of the Chassam Sofer, this is Rav Moshe Sofer, and his congregation from the general Jewish community of Vienna. In the words of the letter that was signed, this is by 390 European rabbis, including Rav Bamberger, this is on page 4. Any Jew who does not believe in the ultimate coming of a Messiah from the descendants of David, in the reunification of the Jewish people in the Holy Land, in the restoration of the sacrificial rites as commanded in the Torah, is to be considered as having defected from Judaism. Furthermore, the elimination of or failure to recite the passages of the prayer book referring to the above-mentioned divine promises implies a defection from Judaism. Therefore, a Torah-true Jew must not and cannot remain associated in one religious community with persons guilty of such apostasy. Just as a background, the major shul, which was a choral synagogue, which Isaac Noah Mannheimer had been the preacher, which up until that time was Orthodox. It was a choral synagogue. They had a cantor, they had a preacher, but the Nusach HaTfilah, the davening, was the Orthodox davening. And they had brought in Rav Zalman Spitzer, who had his own shul. It was called the Schiff Shul. I mean, it was based on the street that it was on. And he had his own, of course, very Orthodox congregants. But he was in charge, he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and he was in charge of all of the kashrus, of the what all that a Rav would be responsible for in a city. The board of the that major synagogue voted that the major synagogue in the city, this choral synagogue, where the people basically probably were not Orthodox in the first place, would we go on lines of reform. They felt more comfortable, and they wanted to have a reform, to convert the main synagogue to be a reform temple. However, says they did not tamper at all with the rest of the community, and Rav Spitzer was still supposed to be the one to oversee all the kashrus, the mikveh, all the shechita, everything that was for the community. And these rabbis rule that since he's really part of one community, he cannot be part of a community that recognized reform as a valid alternative to Orthodoxy. That's what they're. Moreover, according to Jewish doctrine, it is also forbidden to pay taxes to a religious community whose spokesmen have adopted such resolutions that deny the divine promises, whose institutions are not based on the unshakable foundations of religious law as codified in the Shulchan Aruch. Furthermore, and he was one of the signers of this letter, Rav Bamberger. Furthermore, on December 17, 1876, Rav Bamberger supported secession by the Orthodox from the general Reform-controlled community of Wiesbaden and instructed them that affiliation with the general community was strictly forbidden. It is with that background that we present the story of how Rav Bamberger's change in his initial position created a rift within the Orthodox community which reverberates to this day. Now, after witnessing the initial stages of success, of secession, where the majority of Rav Hirsch's congregation, the Israelitische Religion Gesellschaft, was still reluctant to secede, as we described in the last lecture, the communal board of the general community of Frankfurt met on December 22nd, which was of 1876, and decided to counter Rav Hirsch's efforts and to make accommodations for all those who had not yet seceded from the general community. Consequently, they modified their bylaws to allow those Orthodox of the community who did not wish to withdraw to be exempt them from paying that part of the membership fee that was designated for the continued operation of the reform institutions of the city, such as their temple and the philanthropic school, which was a secular Jewish school. On January 26, 1877, Rav Hirsch issued a reply which was distributed to the membership of his congregation, which he gave a detailed analysis of the amendments to the bylaws by the board and continued to forbid membership in the community. The following is an excerpt from Rav Hirsch's reply, and that's on page 4 in paragraph B. This makes it abundantly clear that the entire administration, the taxation, the management of assets, in short, all of the funds required for these administrative structures are used almost exclusively for the religious and educational agencies serving the cause of reform. Therefore, those who continue to make contributions to the budget of the community in accordance with these amendments, even though they may not be taxed directly under the specific headings of quote-unquote worship or quote-unquote education, are still helping to support with their contributions the religious and educational programs of reform. And it continues on, one who fails to secede gives recognition to the principles of reform only by default. And of course, even such a tacit recognition entails a serious responsibility for any sincere adherent of Judaism, Orthodox Torah true Judaism. But one who formally declares his intention to remain a member of the community under the terms of the amendments thereby gives his personal sanction in the most straightforward manner to the defection of reform and denies the truth of orthodoxy because he thereby remains a member of the reform community. He thereby gives formal recognition to the legitimacy of reform. He does not cease, but continually obligates himself anew to commit his assets and his contributions for the support of the religious and educational programs of reform. For the sincere Torah true Jew who knows where his duty lies, there is only one path free of Isser prohibition. Secession from the community under the terms of the law, this is in Germany, of July 28, 1876. Anyone who would persuade his Torah true brethren to do otherwise is a shoyge umajge, one who not only is in error himself, but also leads others astray. Now, this last sentence was specifically aimed at Rav Moshe Mainz and his group, who led the movement for remaining within the general community. Now, 3 days after the letter from Rav Hirsch came out, on January 29, 1877, several opponents of secession sent a request to Rav Bamberger asking his opinion regarding the matter. The following is an excerpt from his reply. Here, this is on paragraph C. This is Würzburg, February 1st, 1877. From the district rabbinate. In other words, he was the rabbi not only of the city of Würzburg, Rav Bamberger, but the whole district, that whole area. To Messrs. Billman and Associates, Frankfurt am Main. In your esteemed letter of the 30th of last month, You informed me that contrary to the categorical pronouncement of your revered Rabbi Hirsch, a large number of members of the Religion Gesellschaft in your city have not only failed to declare their secession from the Reform community, but were in fact about to unite with that community. They cite in their support the supplementary ordinances to the bylaws of the Israelite community. You asked me to give you my opinion on this matter, which I will now do below. I have carefully studied the so-called supplementary ordinances and have found their nature to be such they cannot in any way alter the obligation of an Orthodox Israelite to secede from the Reformed community as been fully and adequately discussed in the analysis of these supplementary ordinances by your revered Rabbi Hirsch dated 26th of last month. I should only like to go into greater detail with regard to the following. It is categorically forbidden for Orthodox Israelites to participate in any manner in the operation and maintenance of a hospital run by a Reformed community, even if one member of the Religion Gesellschaft were to be elected to the board of the Reformed community in connection with that institution. This should be already understood if one considers the observance of dietary laws and Sabbath, not only in connection with patients, but also on the part of the personnel that work in the institution. Furthermore, attention must be given to yet another rule of religious law. It continues, the board members of a community must meet the standards of religious conduct as members of a rabbinical council. This has to be on the same level. Continues on, it follows that an irreligious board of trustees may not be recognized by Orthodox Jews as a board of trustees, and as a consequence, no pious Israelite is permitted to join such a board. In view of the fact that secession from a Reformed community has now become permissible under the law of July 28, 1876, those who do not avail themselves of this law will be acting contrary to the religious rules referred to above and something that certainly they would not wish to do. Respectfully, the District Rabbi. After all of the efforts that were expended by Rav Hirsch, as well as the letter that was sent by Rav Bomberg, the vast majority of the members of Hirsch's congregation, the Israelitische Religion Gesellschaft, still remained undecided whether to secede or not. Fearing the eventual success of Hirsch's efforts, the Reform-controlled board of the general community thereupon proposed to make membership within the community even more tolerable and voted to establish a quote-unquote shechita, a ritual slaughter parallel to that of Hirsch's congregation, but now under the auspices of those of the Orthodox of the community who would not secede. In other words, the general community was about to provide for all of the religious needs of the Orthodox, thus in their thinking making Rav Hirsch's congregation redundant. At this point, an unexpected occurrence took place. Rav Bomberger was asked by those in favor of secession, it seems without Rav Hirsch's knowledge, to come to Frankfurt to convince the group opposed to it, which was led by Rav Moshe Mainz, the leading Talmudic scholar in Frankfurt, and a friend of Rav Bomberger's, and was a person whom, it seems, Rav Bomberger very much respected. Before coming to Frankfurt, however, Rav Bomberger warned them that there was a distinct possibility that instead of him convincing Rav Moshe Mainz and his group, they may well convince him. And that is what actually occurred. On March 19, 1877, upon arriving at Frankfurt, Rav Bomberger, without first making a courtesy call to Rav Hirsch, went directly to a meeting with Rav Mainz and others from the anti-secessionist group. After offering arguments to support their position, Rav Mainz and his group explained to Rav Bomberger that the original circumstances that perhaps may have warranted secession have now changed. And now the general community board was willing to accommodate the religious needs of the Orthodox without their interference and even underwrite its costs. Without first consulting Rav Hirsch, the Morah D'Asra, the Halachic Authority of Frankfurt, Rav Bomberger expressed his halachic opinion to the anti-secessionists that they were in fact allowed to remain within the general community and they did not have to secede. As a result, even before Rav Bomberger left the city, that same evening, the anti-secessionists submitted the following announcement in Rav Bomberger's name to the Frankfurt Boers and Handelszeitung, a newspaper that generally dealt with the needs of the business community. And this is the announcement here on page 5. A short time ago, I was asked by several members of the Religion Gesellschaft of Frankfurt to go there with the objective of persuading a certain person who had heretofore refused to do so to secede. In view of the importance of the matter, I complied with this request. In the course of this discussion, I learned that the community board was now prepared to deal fairly with the Orthodox members who did not secede, that institutions where they needed would be established on their behalf out of communal funds and would be entirely under Orthodox guidelines and supervision, and that, on the other hand, Orthodox members would be exempted from contributing towards the cultural institutions of the Reform movement. I thereupon replied that provided all the necessary guarantees were given for the carrying out of these secessions, it could no longer be deemed necessary to secede from the Reform community. Understandably, Rav Hirsch was quite shocked when shown this news release. Besides for the basic issue, which Rav Hirsch had repeatedly stated, that the very membership in a community that supported Reform was a tacit declaration of Reform Judaism had a legitimate place within the Jewish community, Chas v'Shalom. The very fact that Rav Bamberger, the Rav of Würzburg, an entirely different community, would issue a ruling for the members of the city of Frankfurt, which had its own recognized halakha authority, was unprecedented and quite shocking. Rav Hirsch's response was not long in coming. 4 days after Rav Bamberger's statement appeared, Rav Hirsch gave his Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, the sermon said on the Sabbath before Passover, and to a filled capacity crowd of 1,000, reaffirmed his position that it was an absolute chiyuv duty to secede, and severely criticized the Würzburger's Rav's ruling. 3 days after that, 2 days before Pesach, an open letter of 28 printed pages appeared, in which Rav Hirsch carefully defended his position and openly criticized Rav Bamberger for issuing such a ruling. The following is an excerpt from that letter. Here is on paragraph E. Honorable Rabbi Bamberger, if anyone had told me only a few weeks ago that after having written so many public statements against Messrs. Abraham Geiger, Zacharias Frankel, Heinrich Gretz, and others of similar leanings, the dictates of my conscience would force me to compose a public statement against Rabbi Bamberger, the district rabbi of Würzburg, on behalf of these same sacred principles. If anyone had told me that I would live to see Rabbi Bamberger, the district rabbi of Würzburg, lend the weight of his personal integrity and prestige to endeavors directed at nothing less than jeopardizing the survival and development of our Religion Gesellschaft, on which after long and bitter experiences God has bestowed the great favor of permitting it to become, through its modest endeavors, the cornerstone for the reconstruction of Torah true Judaism within German Jewry. If anyone had told me that Rabbi Bamberger, the district rabbi of Würzburg, without doubt is fully aware of what law and tradition sanction as permissible in the rabbinical profession with regard to communal affairs, would unhesitatingly permit himself to issue a ruling of heter, ruling that something be allowed, even in the tiniest village outside his jurisdiction, and even with regards to a purely internal, unimportant question in which the rabbi of the community had already issued a ruling of iser, prohibiting the thing, let alone a community such as the Israelitische Religion Gesellschaft in Frankfurt am Main, concerning a matter of such universal, fundamental, and far-reaching significance. If anyone had told me these things, or even only one of them, I would have turned my back on that man as a malicious teller of wild tales. And he continues on, for indeed it is true that in the last few weeks things have come to pass which would not have occurred even in a dream to intelligent, clear-thinking men. And he continues on, permit me, therefore, honorable sir, to begin by presenting the facts in completely objective terms. And he continues on, an Orthodox Jew remains a member of the Reform community even though he can and does have the use of all the religious institutions he needs elsewhere, remains a member of that Reform community only for the sake of being a member. He thereby makes it clear beyond question his personal religious conscience, approves the idea that Jews may create and support for use by non-Orthodox Jews, Reform institutions that violate religious law. It is difficult to believe that you were fully aware of the implications of your statement. Continues on. In other words, the Orthodox conscience can accept the existence before the one sole God and his own soul, his one sole law of two kinds of Judaism, each co-equal with the other, the one with the Torah and the other against the Torah, all depending upon the views of the individual. In your view, even the most extreme Reformed community is koshered if its members maintain kosher institutions. And he continues on, what name would you give to a system whose pulpit and school preach and teach that mitzvahs atar v'chukosel, the commands of the Torah and its statutes, are outdated, and that applies this principle, that applies this principle also in the shaping of its other institutions? He continues on, can it be anything else? Those most blatant minus v'afakursus, apostasy and heresy? Continues on, dear Rabbi, you will vainly search through all of Jewish history as long as Jewish life was shaped by the authority of Jewish religious law for another instance of a hybrid kahila community, such as the one upon which you have conferred legitimacy. And it continues on, I am still confident that either now or sometime in the future, you will realize that you were in error. And he concludes, in this anticipation, with respect and high esteem as ever, I remain very sincerely yours, Samson Folhert. Because this is only an excerpt, there are 28 pages. He wanted to come home tonight. Less than 6 weeks after Rav Hirsch's open letter was published, Rav Bamberger defended his position in an open reply. Paragraph F on page 6, we quote an excerpt of that letter. Dear sir,
Rabbi,
you'll see. I have carefully and repeatedly read and studied the quote-unquote open letter you have addressed to me with regard to the matter of secession from the community in your city. You'll permit me, dear Rabbi, to reply to your own letter in a logical order as follows. And you see, the whole tone is very condescending. One. Regarding your categorical ruling that secession from the Reformed community in your city is an unqualified requirement of the religious law, and this must be done, even if the conditions I've stipulated were to be met. See, that's your position. One. Two. Regarding your claim that under religious law, I had no authority whatsoever to come out in opposition to your ruling, since I am not allowed to declare as permitted that which you have declared to be forbidden. Three, regarding the two opinions I have issued in this matter, then he's pointing out that he had previously issued opinions that one is required to secede, and it seems to be in contradiction to his previous opinions. And four, regarding the arguments you have cited as proof and documentation for your decisions. In one, in the first part. I will subject these arguments to a careful scrutiny beneath the brilliant light of the authority of religious law. One, you have expressed in the curtest possible terms ideas that will deeply insult and aggrieve any pious Israelite. You have discharged arrows that must wound their hearts very deeply. And against whom, dear Rabbi, have you proceeded in this manner? Against all those who refuse to secede from the community, that is, against hundreds of men generally recognized as being religious. Among them, there are many chachmei v'lomdei Torah v'oskim b'mitzvahs, scholars, students of Torah, and involved in the fulfillment of the commandments. With Harav HaMuflag HaChorav Uboki B'Chedrei Torah U'Medaktek B'Mitzvahs Kvoid Moreno Harav Moshe Mainz Nat Rachmano Parke, the pious and outstanding, brilliant, erudite scholar of Moshe Mainz, may Hashem protect him, at their head. I have abbreviated this description according to the principle of our sages, Miksa Shvocha B'Fonav. One only gives partial praise in the person's presence. You have further said to these men.
How old is Rabbi Hirsch at this point?
What?
How old is Rabbi Hirsch at this point?
Rabbi Hirsch was born in 1808. So he's 67, 66.
He's established.
What?
Well established.
Yeah. You have further said to these men, quote, "Religious truth has become altogether meaningless to you. You pay attention to religious matters only out of extraneous circumstances," end quote. Now you will surely concede, dear Rabbi, that someone else too can and may have, quote, "a most profound and earnest belief," end quote, of his own. And if, as in this particular case, this belief should be opposed to your own, does that give you the right to speak in this manner to those who hold it? Continues on. "Should you not rather have chosen the proper way, which would have been to say to these men, 'My brethren, I consider your views just as totally erroneous as you consider mine. But come, let us not quarrel on that account. We're after all brothers. Let us choose three rabbis to whom we will present our respective opinions and whose opinion we will accept." That would have been the proper way, conducive to the desired effect. Or if you would have considered such an action with the opposing sides beneath your dignity, notwithstanding the substantial number and respectability of those individuals, you should have addressed yourself privately to some rabbinic authorities. You should have presented the case to them in the context of the conditions stipulated by me and asked them for their opinion in the matter. After all, this has been the accepted rabbinical procedure since the days of the Gaonim, scholars of the Gaonic era, and it is the substance of all our Sifrei Shilas and Tshuvas response to literature. It continues on, "For surely Rav Moshe Mainz would have been ready at once to bow to the decision of such a Beis Din, and all the other gentlemen certainly would have followed suit." That's the first two. The principle, Chacham She'osar says, "Ein Chaver Rishoy Lahater," if a scholar issued a ruling forbidding a certain thing, his rabbinic colleague is not allowed to permit it, can be invoked only if the rabbinic qualification of both authorities consulted are equal. If, on the other hand, the second authority is recognized having outstanding qualifications, in other words, Rav Bamberger considered Rav Hirsch as a very inferior scholar, that authority is under no obligation to defer to a ruling which, according to his conviction, is an error. Anyone entrusted to any degree with Hayroah, issuing rabbinic decisions, will know that the principle Chacham She'osar assumes as implicit one's condition, which is definitely lacking in your Hayroah. Rav Herschel, he disagrees with this as well. It must first of all have been universally accepted and recognized as correct, and must not have been refuted as incorrect from the very start. Now, dear Rabbi, has this been true in the case of your Hayroah? Was it recognized, accepted as correct? Did it not rather meet with opposition from the very start? Now the other gentlemen cannot be faulted if they regard Rav Moshe Mainz as qualified for Hayroah, as you yourself admit. And if they then follow his Hayroah not to secede, they have every right to do so. You should really have considered all this, dear Rabbi, before presenting your claim as dogmatically in such a style as you did. Three. You claim, dear Rabbi, that you found a contradiction between the two opinions I have rendered in this matter. It continues on. Now, the test to establish whether Reformed community and its trustees belong to the first category is lahachas umesis umediyah, one who acts with premeditation out of spite, or someone who entices others to sin, or to the second category, a lack of understanding, should be quite easy. Initially, there was no question of the board making concessions to those Orthodox members who did not wish to secede. Of course, I could not any permit anyone to remain a member of the community under such terms. We continued. Now, however, the board not only recognized the legitimacy of the religious requirements of the Orthodox, it is also ready to permit the implementation of measures to provide for their needs. In other words, the board has no wish to deny vis-a-vis the Orthodox the strict and sacred binding authority of the Torah. Not only does the board not seek to impede the observance of the law of Torah, but will endeavor to facilitate it. The fact remains that by offering the above-mentioned concessions, they want to make certain they will not appear as lahachas, as mesis or mediac, one who acts with premeditation out of spite, someone who entices others to sin. On the contrary, they wish to entrust the safeguarding protection of these sacred religious concerns entirely to the administration and supervision of the Orthodox, thus protecting these interests from any interference on their own part. And then four, and as it continues, after a critical analysis of the proof text cited by Rav Hirsch, Rav Bomberg continues, "Do you, dear Rabbi, write this in a spirit of calm deliberation?" And it continues, "Their remaining within the community should be viewed not as a deliberate, unjustifiable act, but as serving a noble purpose. This should be obvious if we consider the three classes in which the Israelites of Frankfurt can be grouped. A, the strictly Orthodox, that is the Religion Gesellschaft. B, the strict reformers, that is the members of the Israelite community who adhere to reform and practice. And C, those who have joined neither the Religion Gesellschaft nor the institutions of reform." And he continues, "This class, as far as I know, comprises a rather numerous group who do not subscribe to the principles of reform but want to conduct their lives in the spirit of orthodoxy." And he continues, "However, does this give us the right to say, quote, these people must remain without a mikveh, without a kosher butchers, they must not have a synagogue in the orthodox sense of the term," end quote. Certainly not. "Therefore, the fact that those who do not secede will contribute with their community tax establishment of such institutions within the community cannot yield the conclusion that secession is mandatory and that the non-secession must be described as a deliberate, unjustifiable act." Okay, this was an excerpt from the open letter which Rav Bomberger. Rav Hirsch's response came within a matter of days. In a very lengthy critique of both Rav Bomberger's halachic position and the manner in which Rav Bomberger formulated his letter, Rav Hirsch passionately attacked Rav Bomberger and further articulated his own position. To give you a sense of the tone and content of that response, we quote an excerpt from it on page 8. This is paragraph G. "To the Reverend District Rabbi S.B. Zeligber Bomberger, Würzburg, Reverend Sir, 1. I divided it. "Every argument presented in your open reply to sustain your ruling in favor of non-secession from the Reformed community of this city and to refute the arguments cited in my letters shows incredible prejudice and incomprehensible misinterpretation and in part denial of the true facts in the situation. Your arguments demonstrate a failure to grasp the standards set down in Shas, the Talmud, and Poskim, halakhic authorities, standards in which any Moira HaRobi Yisrael, halakhic decision maker, must base his rulings, and a misinterpretation of the passages cited. You have cavalierly dismissed, with empty phrases that cannot possibly justify, one of the sacred questions that touch upon the most vital nerve of the future development of Torah through Judaism." Continues on. "You launch a campaign against my open letter with a folly which the thoughtful, conscientious Rabbi Bomberger of an earlier day would surely never have committed." He continues, "You speak of the great offense I have committed against all those in Frankfurt elsewhere who have not seceded. My offense was that I depicted with all of the intensity of my personal conviction the serious responsibility assumed by those who have failed to secede, and that I thereby pronounce an indictment against all those who did not share my conviction in this respect." It continues, "Sir, if the man entrusted with the safeguarding of religious law in his community sees that wrong is being done, and because he might antagonize someone he is not permitted to point it out with all of the zeal and rigor of his personal conviction, well, that would be the end of all rabbinic instruction in Israel." And it continues, "As regard to the halo of Lamdonis Talmudic scholarship and Sidkis righteousness, which you so kindly conferred upon the gentlemen of my congregation who are opposed to secession and agitate for non-secession, I have no desire to pluck even one leaf from the Jewish laurels with which these gentlemen have been crowned by you." And it continues, "The opposition of these gentlemen to secession dates back to the first moment, September 1876, which I and the trustees of our community implemented our secession in accordance with the law of July 28, 1876. And so I would shout this question to you, What about the Lamdonis, Talmudic scholarship, Tzidkus, righteousness of these same gentlemen during all the time before these concessions were offered? When according to your own two opinions, one of which was signed together with almost 400 rabbis, Pharaoh to secede was categorically condemned as Isser Gomer, completely forbidden. And it continues on, I have mentioned your own two opinions. The defection from Jewish truth in Vienna was worlds apart from the defection practiced by Reform in the city. At the time the opinions were obtained, Shechita, ritual slaughter, mikveh, and all the other institutions, a matter of Isser Vehetter, ritual law, in regard to that which was forbidden or permitted in Vienna, were subject to the authority of Rabbi Spitzer, who engaged by the community expressly for such hayroah, Isser Vehetter, decision making. All of the institutions that are now to be created in Frankfurt only with the greatest difficulty and only after the offer of the so-called concessions on which you based your declaration of secession is no longer mandatory have been fully operational in Vienna for some time. It never occurred to anyone to change the Orthodox institutions in any manner. It continues. Now this decision, which is made by you, yourself, and some 400 other rabbis, which cannot be explained away, has already decided the question of secession in Frankfurt and has virtually removed it from discussion for all practical purposes. You yourself, along with such an impressive number of other authorities, have therefore decided that failure to secede from the Reformed community in Frankfurt is an Isser Gomer, completely forbidden, even if the promised concessions were to materialize. And it continues, in view of the foregoing, anyone who will see the truly childlike character of your grandfatherly advice that I should have consulted a three-man court of arbitration or obtained rabbinical opinions, etc. And it continues on. With regards to point two of your open reply, which you wish to clear yourself of the charge of having transgressed the canon, that Chacham Sh'osser and Chacham Rishoy Lahater, a scholar issued a ruling forbidding a certain thing, his rabbinic colleague is not allowed to permit it. But you did not even attempt to prove that the Chacham Sh'osser, the rabbinic authority who forbade the matter, had been of Toyas B'dvar Mishnah, an error due to ignorance of an explicit authoritative ruling, literal of a Mishnah. You've also failed to demonstrate that the Chacham Sh'osser was guilty of a Toyas B'shikol Adas, an error in judgment. Then after a lengthy and critical analysis of the sources, Rav Hirsch writes, and let us assume that you were correct about all the foregoing, as you were very clearly in the wrong. Let us assume that had you lived in the same city as I, you have had the right lahatar masha sarti, which would certainly not have been the case. But having done so as a rabbi not residing in my locality, you have been guilty of an impropriety that should weigh heavily on your conscience. Reb Bamberger had stated in his open letter, which I had not quoted, given the present circumstance, the point of Mora Da'as, or local halachic authority, he's quoting Reb Bamberger's open letter, and then he's going to reply. But this is a quote from the letter. He says, given the present circumstance, the point of Mora Da'as, or local halachic authority, does not have any justification. He said, Reb Hirsch cannot use this. This surely is not in need of explanation.
That's
Rav Hirsch. This is all Reb Bamberger saying. That it's without justification. I don't even have to say anything. A challenge of authority of the Mora Da'as local is described in Shas and Poskim, not as keneged adin against the law, but merely lav oirich ara, which Reb Bamberger translates not customary.
Right.
Not customary. Now, after he had quoted this from Reb Bamberger, Reb Hirsch now replies. However, contrary to your erroneous interpretation, this latter phrase did not have the connotation of not customary, but denotes an act contrary to the standards of derech eretz, socially acceptable behavior, standards which we would have to assert and put into practice, even if, God forbid, they were not customary. Or is it possible that Masechta Derech Eretz, attractive Derech Eretz, is not part of the personal official library, of the life of a district rabbi in Würzburg? Maybe you just don't have it available to you. And he continues, Derech Eretz are the fundamental rules that are to regulate the coexistence of human beings. And he continues, moreover, the circumstances involved were of a kind which you as an outsider were no position at all to judge. Thus you lack the most elementary qualifications for a Baal Hayroah, a qualified decision maker. Namely, a thorough knowledge of the question decided upon in accordance with the law. The laws concerning a broken chicken wing are in the same everywhere, in Frankfurt and Würzburg and New York and New Zealand, that the conditions such as those discussed in the matter of secession in the city, on which you based your heter permissive ruling, can be adequately known and judged only by persons living here. And he continues on. Instead, you cavalierly declare as mutter permitted that which I have declared as usser, and you did so without even personally discussing the case with me, the Mora, the Asra, the local halachic authority. Truly, continues on, the Knesset Gdola, author of the halachic works, says Knesset Gdola, who declared based on the Shabbos Yutesom and Beis, Menadinosov, that one puts in a ban, says, for such a thing that if one rules against the Mora da Asra, one is from a different community, and rules against the local authority concerning a chacham who presumes to practice hayroah in a community which does not reside, in opposition to the rabbi of the community, says, and he says that person should be banned, should be put into cherem. Knew whereof he spoke. What would become of us? What would be our end if the dangerous example you have set would be followed also elsewhere? He continues, I believe that all the foregoing should make it clear to anyone with knowledge of the subject that all your attempts to justify your ruling that it is mutter not to secede from the Reform community in this city, which I have declared as osur, are completely invalid in form. And he continues on number three. According to Jewish religious law, there's no difference between a Jew who has been baptized and a mean heretic who, by attitude or conduct, has defected from Kol HaTorah Kulu, the entire Torah, but who retains a superficial connection with Jewry because he never, this is quote-unquote, converted to another religion. And he continues, this, dear Rabbi, is one more demonstration of complete thoughtlessness on your part. Has not the Reform movement of our own day from the very beginning engaged in active propaganda on behalf of its minus and apocursus, heresy and apostasy? Has not Reform created a whole literature, shall minus heresy? And it continues, is Geiger's prayer book, which is used at the main synagogue in his synagogue, along with its preface, not a sefer minus, heretical text? And what about the educational institutions of Reform and their teachers, who by their own personal example teach the young, Chilul Shabbos, desecration of the Sabbath, Achilas Macholas Asuras, eating forbidden foods. He continues, our reformers deny the basic truth of Judaism. They transgress the divinely ordained laws because they no longer consider these laws binding upon them. They not only do not consider such transgressions as sin, as oven, but actually regard them as mitzvah, a sign of praiseworthy progress. And continues, furthermore, you name Mesis or Medea, someone who entices others to sin, as one characteristic of minus and apocursus, heresy and apostasy, that would make the act of secession mandatory. I must tell you that such a criterion is not mentioned in any of the sources of our religious law. But if you should insist, well, I've already shown the extent to which from the very beginning Reform, with its literature, its periodicals, its sermons, its rabbinical conferences, its pulpits and its schools, especially the latter, has proven to be Mesis and Medea enticing others to sin. One great missionary institution converted the Jews to defection from the law. And he continues, how then could we accept these concessions by the Reform Board, i.e. the establishment of kashrus, institutions for the Orthodox, as an act of homage to the strict and sacred binding authority of the Torah? If at the same time the pulpit and the school of that same board continue their vociferous denial of the binding authority of the Torah. And he continues, I've also pointed out that as long as the non-seceders will remain members of the Reformed community, the assets of that community will continue to be theirs as well. So that in fact their own assets will be used for the cultivation and maintenance of Reform. Hence, by contributing money to such a community, they'll be using their assets to be machzik ovrei avera, supporting evildoers. And then it continues, finally, I demonstrate to you that by keeping Religion Gesellschaft members from seceding, the wedge of dissension, the miasma paralysis will be used to jeopardize the survival of the Religion Gesellschaft. And it continues, with a self-assured air of familiarity with conditions in the city, such as could hardly be expected of an outsider, you have grouped the Israelites of Frankfurt into three classes. You note those whom you have placed in class C comprise a rather numerous group who do not subscribe to principles of reform, but want to conduct their lives in the spirit of orthodoxy. And it continues, what should one call Jews who, quote, do not subscribe to the principle of reform, end quote, who recognize that to be, quote, unquote, orthodox is the proper way commanded by God's law, but who nevertheless, according to your assertion, eat in the veil of trefa, non-kosher prepared meat, even though they could have strictly kosher meat in just two paces away? What should one call Jews who claim to be orthodox, but who, according to your assertion, conduct their marriages without the mikveh, thereby committing a most serious chi of chorus, crime that warrants a premature death, even though a mikveh is available to them just two paces away? And you would persuade yourself and us that these Jews of a very peculiar orthodoxy would make use of the mikveh and of kosher butchers more than they do at present, if only these facilities were offered them by courtesy of a new supplier. And he continues after he quotes directly from Rav Spitzer regarding the conditions within the Vienna community that brought about the ruling of the nearly 400 rabbis one is required to secede from such a community. Hirsch wrote the following. However, it's evident from Rabbi Spitzer's statement that when you, in conjunction with nearly 400 other rabbis, declared secession as mandatory and non-secession as categorically ausser, it was solely on account of the proposed liturgical changes at one Reformed congregation. For at that time, all the other institutions, entire Haros, Isser Beheter, decision makers to whether something is permitted or forbidden, existed in Vienna, inviolate and in full accord with Jewish law. Hence, there is no basis for your argument, and your Heter permissive ruling stands condemned by your rabbinic opinion. Continue, I'm certain that even if you were to have the sad audacity to behold your Heter declaration, contrary to your own previous opinion, that and that of a majority of Chachmei Yisrael, this opinion of yours will remain buckle, void, and insignificant, and of no consequence for my own community. And continued, personally, my health has suffered, my energies are not equal to it, and I was able to write even this article only with great effort and frequent pauses for rest. I must therefore save the little strength that God may yet give me for the most necessary efforts. And he continues, therefore, please, do not persist in this untenable position. God knows what it was that got you into it. And do not permit the destructive consequences of your conduct, which was based on error, to continue gaining ground in Jewish circles. And he continues, show that you are such a true sage. Pronounce the simple, candid word, Toisi, I have erred, to expunge from your life that episode which brought you which brought so much grief to you, to your friends, and to the cause itself. Say this one little word to restore yourself to the pure and true position of the district Rabbi Bamberger of old, and you will receive the redoubted respect and esteem of all, not least among them of yours most faithfully, Samson Raffold. Now, although Rav Hildesheimer had worked hand in hand with Rav Hirsch to secure passage of the secession law, and his own community in Berlin did secede, Rav Hildesheimer did not publicly take sides for fear that it would only split German Orthodoxy only further, and would also jeopardize the viability of his rabbinic seminary. Privately, however, Rav Hildesheimer supported Rav Hirsch's position in a letter dated the 16th of Tammuz, 1877, Hildesheimer wrote, quote, I cannot express in words the great pleasure I had in reading your all-encompassing and incontrovertible reasoning. And it continues, in my opinion, you have brought to the question a conclusion that is inevitable for anyone who recognizes the truth. The service you have done joins your many achievements in presenting the clear truth to the Orthodox community. This latest accomplishment is worthy of all of the others and as important as any of them, end quote.
Yeah.
This is Rav Hildesheimer, right, that after Rav Hirsch had written this last open letter, this Rav Hildesheimer wrote a letter to Rav Hirsch. It is important to note, however, that despite Rav Hildesheimer's support of secession of the Orthodox community from the general Reformed community, Rav Hildesheimer did maintain that he was permitted to join with the non-Orthodox in areas apart from religion, such as support from the Allianz Israelite Universelle, a Paris-based Jewish charitable and educational organization, which is largely made up of secular and non-Orthodox Jews, including many graduates of the conservative Breslau Seminary. Rav Hirsch, however, was firmly opposed to such participation. Shortly after these events, Rav Moshe Mainz asked one of Rav Hildesheimer's most beloved Talmidim, Harav HaGoyen Rav Mordechai Halevi Hurwitz, who himself was opposed to Auschwitz, he was opposed to it. He was one of the rabbis who did not sign on the letter that Rav Spitzer leave the Vienna community. And asked this Rav Hurwitz, he was an Einikel, he was a descendant of the Shiloh HaKadosh, to head a new Orthodox congregation in Frankfurt, sponsored by the General Community Board. Despite objections by Rav Hildesheimer, his Rebbe, Rav Hurwitz accepted that position and built an Orthodox congregation that catered to the needs of those who did not want to associate themselves with Rav Hirsch's approach to separation from the general community. It seems from various accounts that the efforts of Rav Hurwitz did meet with success, and he was makarev by close many who would otherwise have been lost. Rav Hirsch and those loyal to him, however, were strongly opposed to his having Rav Hurwitz formed an Orthodox congregation as part of the general community, first upon principle, and second in violation of the Psak, the ruling of the Mora d'Asra, Rav Hirsch, the chief halachic authority of Frankfurt. In defense of such an action, Rav Moshe Lev Bamberger, a great-grandson of the Würzburger Rav, wrote, I quote, "The Auschwitz secession policy had the great merit of creating independent bulwarks of Orthodox life, but had to be content with losing all direct influence on those outside their ranks. The opposition to Auschwitz, by not severing all ties, on the other hand, risks becoming adversely influenced by the anti-Torah views of the followers of Reform. But on the other hand, they could maintain their influence on many fellow Jews who would otherwise have been driven towards assimilation and loss of faith in Jewish tradition. Retrospectively, it may be said that Providence needed both ways for the preservation of traditionalism as a consistent and influential factor within Jewry." End quote. So this was a great-grandson of the Würzburger Rav, Bamberger, who basically looked in retrospect that both were important.
Did he respond to Rav Hirsch's letter?
He asked if Rav Bamberger did not respond to Rav Hirsch's letter. And in fact, two years later, he passed away. Rav Hirsch was not at the Levaya. Rather, the great Rabbanim, the prestige of the many communities, came to join at the Levaya of Rav Bamberger, who was the leading poisik in Germany. Rav Hirsch did not come.
But he was already received the letter of Bamberger.
What?
He was in receipt of the letter where Rav Bamberger would basically read it.
With
what you read?
No, what I read is from a great
prior to that.
I mean, the other one. Right. I mean, Rav Hirsch had made his opinion point. Rav Bamberger did not reply to that, and that's how it remains. Rav Hurwitz's creation of a non-secession, this Orthodox congregation, which was really the first of its kind, I mean, after this ruling of secession, had great historical implications as it laid the groundwork for many other such congregations, and eventually split German Orthodoxy in two. The followers of Hirsch eventually became the backbone of the Agudas Yisrael, and that was founded decades later, and the Mizrahi, the religious Zionists, who worked together with the general Zionist movement, something to which Rav Hirsch would have been strongly opposed. The details of that split will be covered in Mirtz Hashem in a future lecture. The last section of this of the notes deal with the last days and death of Shantrafal Hirsch. Let me just quote to you from the eulogy that was given at Rav Hirsch's Shloshim 30 days after his passing by his son, Rabbi Dr. Mendel Hirsch. This is in the last page of your notes. How shall I describe him, and how shall I remember him? Shall I speak about the man, about the greatness and the wonder that revealed themselves in his private interactions with people, the son, brother, and the husband he was? How the words of the marriage ceremony you are consecrated to me were a living reality in his life? Shall I tell what kind of a father he was, the glory and splendor of his personality, his lofty character, his firmness of will, and his iron self-control? Shall I speak of his unwavering diligence in Torah study, his tireless dedication to his work, and how he pushed himself incessantly and never delayed the fulfillment of his obligations, how he never relinquished a project from the time he embarked on it until he brought it to completion, regardless of the amount of time it took? Or shall I tell of the depth of his intelligence, his boundless creativity and sharp intellect that expressed themselves in the penetrating look which he scrutinized everything? Who could see those eyes and not feel that he had penetrated to the depths of his soul? Who is there who requested his advice on any matter and did not find the answer they received to be anything other than the precisely correct solution to his problem? Shall I speak of his warm congeniality, his sense of humor, and the sharp witticism that occasionally shot out from him like a bolt of lightning? Shall I speak of his endless patience, his refreshing personality, his incomparable acts of kindness and charity? One had to be only poor and wretched to be assured of finding by him an open door, an attentive ear, and a warm heart ready to listen to help. Shall I speak of the deep equanimity and serenity of soul that enabled him to persevere in his Torah studies and to continue his prolific work at all times, even on occasion of sadness or joy, when others would not have succeeded in carrying on? Shall I speak of his sensitivity and the profundity of his fear of God and his faith and trust in Hashem? Anyone who had the privilege of seeing him at prayer could not help but recognize these lofty qualities in him and feel how inadequate he himself was in these areas. Now this concludes this year's series, part two of From the Ghetto to Emancipation. Baruch Hashem, this is also the end of our 23rd season. We began the fall of 1992. As in the past, I would like to take this opportunity to thank Dr. Mark Blumenkel for all his efforts. Without him, this class could not be possible. I'd also like to thank Mrs. Rabinowitz for graciously helping us out. A special thanks to Rabbi Mrs. Michal Cohen and the Young Israel of Oak Park for being such gracious hosts, and a special thanks to Mr. Steve Katz for making sure that everything ran smoothly. Thank you all for coming, and I hope to see you next season. A gute Woche and a gute Gewen Shteyar. Now, are there any questions? You're asking about why, of all of the great German Rabbonim, those who are not familiar with German history.
Right.
All those who haven't attended this lecture, heard the lecture.
Right.
Why is it that they know of Rav Hirsch? Mm-hmm. I think really for two reasons. First of all, it was Rav Hirsch, it would be anyone who saved German Orthodoxy. And really created the framework which that Orthodoxy could be preserved, you know, in a modern world by those who were willing to embrace modernity, you know, at least in one form or another. Second of all, as we quoted in a previous lecture about his philosophy, he created a philosophy of Judaism that created which was appealing to the Western mind. In other words, the great philosophers lived in a different era. And they were imbued either from, they were speaking either from Aristotelian Greek philosophical viewpoint or from a Kabbalistic viewpoint. The Hasidus is based on that viewpoint. But from someone who is neither Aristotelian nor is Kabbalistic, but is wants to embrace orthodoxy as it seems to be expressed in the Talmud, you know, and it's and yet has embraced the modern world. He created such a philosophy, and it's really to his efforts that we see much of what we see today. You're asking me what is my opinion, who is right between the Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Hildesheimer vis-a-vis how it was in Hungary.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you're asking about who would be, you know, it reminds me of this story. You know, this about a person, a cousin Louis came to visit his relatives. He was going to stay just for a few days. For a few days came a few weeks and a few months. It was a half a year already, and it seems that cousin Louis had no thoughts about leaving. And the husband said, "We have to get rid of him." So you know what? We're going to feign a fight. We're going to scream at each other. We're going to throw things at each other. And finally, each one is going to look at him, going to point. And Louis says, "Who's right?" If he says, "You're right," I'm going to throw him out. And if he says, "I'm right," you're going to throw him out. They agreed to this, and they had the whole fight. The china was being thrown, the chairs were being thrown. And finally, they looked to Louis. "Louis, what do you say?" Louis says, "I've been here 6 months already. I really like it here. I want to stay at least another 6 months. I don't want to get involved." That's my answer to it. Yeah.
I missed several of the lectures, so if this has been asked and answered, I apologize. But what would these opinions say about something like Federation here in Detroit? That's question number one. Question number two, with regard to Yiddish as a central language, it seemed that was a focus as to whether or not Yiddish should be spoken, German should be spoken. And is it the issue of Yiddish itself? I mean, that seems kind of strange, because Jews have used Aramaic, have used Arabic, other languages, so it doesn't seem that, is it the seclusion of Jews away from the general culture that was the reason for wanting to keep Yiddish.
Okay, so you're asking two questions. You're asking first about how would they view Federation. Well, certainly what we said, how Sham Shmuel Hirsch would view Federation, would say that even though it's not a religious organization, even though it maybe support areas which are religious or support things which the ideology is not orthodox, he would, I think his view would be to stay far, far away from it. Right. Others would not have that thing, but that's certainly Sham Shmuel Hirsch and those who followed in his path would be very uncomfortable with being with Federation. Others not, but you're asking Sham Shmuel Hirsch. Saying in terms of the language of Yiddish, I believe it isn't so much the Yiddish, the language so much, but what it represented. The Yiddish really represented the culture of European Jewry that lasted many hundreds of years, that was still embraced by those who were deeply observant. German, by and large, was the language of those who had assimilated. And really it was a question, German versus Yiddish, in their minds was assimilation versus non-assimilation. That's why it was such a heated issue. Yeah. A gute Woche. Yeah, Asher Bamber is a very big Talmud Chacham. No, well, you're asking about. Yeah. He was evidently he had. There was a major problem with his reply, a major problem. There are those who say, really, you know, he died 2 years later. He was already older. He was not the same Reb Bamberger. He was already going through an aging process. There are those who say that open reply that he made was really not written by him because he was older. It was written by people from his group who were not on the same level. Therefore, he could not reply to it. It's very hard. It's hard to know. But he was, in his day, he was from the great poskim. In fact, with David Zvi Hoffman, after leaving, Rav Hildesheimer studied under Rav Bamberger. Okay, good luck.